now is the time for anybody else with a ballot in hand or about to have a ballot in hand to return your ballot. And at this point, we are not recommending that anybody put their ballots in the mail.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point.
I don't know what's going on with the United States Postal Service. I don't trust it, so I actually had a vote by mail ballot, but I brought it, gave it back to them, and I wanted my vote to count on that day.
And welcome to Friday.
There's no way to sugarcoat it. We are facing an urgent crisis, and there is an imminent risk to you, your family members, your friends, your neighbors, and the people you care about.
Well, from top to bottom, you just heard Pennsylvania Secretary of State Kathy Buchvar encouraging voters not to use the mail if they want to get their ballots in on time. Then the voice of a Florida voter heeding similar advice in her state. And Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers sounding the alarm about the massive rise in COVID cases there. And that is where we will start trying to tie together the threads of this week's news. Joining us from Madison is Molly Beck. She covers state politics and government for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Molly, it's great to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So first of all, let's start with those COVID cases. How large is the spike in Wisconsin right now?
It's large and it's continuing. It's almost not a spike. It seems to be more of a wave at this point. This week, we've seen our largest single day number of new cases, which was over 5,200 cases. And that's, you know, the context is Wisconsin has fewer than 6 million people. So that's a lot of new cases in one day. There were 64 deaths that day. And, you know, the rest of the week, we've seen, you know, 3,800 new cases. And yesterday was 4,800 new cases. And this has been happening for over about 2 weeks, maybe more, and it doesn't seem to be letting up.
Wow. And the hospitalizations, and how's the healthcare system coping there?
Yeah, I mean, it's overwhelmed in a couple different areas, northeastern Wisconsin, where Green Bay is, and Marinette, and you know, there's the big population centers are not there, but those hospitals and healthcare facilities are pretty overwhelmed to the point that the governor had to open a field hospital a couple weeks ago to provide relief for those hospitals. We're also seeing, hospitals here in Madison having to open their fourth COVID-19 only ICU units. So we're seeing, you know, stress on hospitals everywhere in the state.
So then how is that playing out in terms of the presidential campaign? Because Wisconsin is seen as a key state in the path to the White House. So what's been going on politically there this week?
Yeah, I mean, the last couple of weeks have been, at least for the Trump campaign, have been exactly what we would have expected had there not been a pandemic. You know, we have seen him here. He was here last week. He was here on Saturday. He was here on Tuesday. He was here. He's going to be here today. We think he's going to be back before Tuesday. And the rallies he's holding are thousands of people big, you know. And at those rallies, he's talking about how the pandemic is rounding the corner. But at the same time, you know, the numbers of cases keep going up and the hospitalizations are going up. So the message of rounding the corner is a much different story they're reading in the newspaper when they read the stories about the situation, the coronavirus situation here.
And it almost sounds like you're describing two different worlds, but certainly are they colliding in the minds of voters? How are voters responding to this massive or this continuous growth in COVID cases for Wisconsin? And at the same time, you know, politics and rallies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how it's playing with the president's base of support here in Wisconsin. The rallies are as big as they were, you know, from 2016 on. You know, every rally I've covered have been that big. But we're seeing the state legislative races. I think that's where we're seeing the, you know, voters' opinions shifting, and maybe because of the pandemic and perhaps the president's handling of it, or it might be tied to the legislature's handling of it. But state legislative races in the Milwaukee suburbs that have not been competitive for a long time have since 2016 been competitive. And right now we're hearing from voters there, and we're seeing, you know, the Democratic opponents' campaigns are all about the pandemic. So they must be seeing, you know, some, you know, voter opinions that are tied to the pandemic there. And we also, there was some state polling this week that showed that the opinion of the Republican-led legislature has fallen since May. And in that time, you know, the pandemic has just continued to surge here.
Huh. Well, and just to be clear, fact check me on something, Molly, there are, in terms of COVID restrictions in Wisconsin, doesn't seem like there are many right now.
No, there are not. There is one. There's a statewide mask mandate. There was an order to limit capacity in bars and restaurants. That the governor was sued over that. And right now those restrictions are not in place. Earlier this year in May, the Republican leaders of the legislature sued the governor over the stay-at-home order and knocked that down and limited his ability to issue orders like that. So we don't have any restrictions to speak of right now.
Okay, so speaking of the courts, one more question for you, Molly, because this helps us peer into next week. Obviously, there was that big legal decision about the Supreme Court keeping in place Wisconsin's rule that for absentee ballots to be counted, they have to be received, right, by the end mm-hmm. of Election Day, or I should say mm-hmm. November 3rd, next week. How is that playing out in terms of the actual voting? What's the impact of that been in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so we saw after that ruling, we saw, you know, some messaging from clerk's offices and you know, even some of the political parties saying do not mail your ballot. You know, if after this certain day, do not mail it. Don't mail it. Just bring it to one of the ballot boxes or bring it to your clerk's office. And I think it's hard to say how many ballots that will affect ultimately. It's hard to know beyond thousands. Mm-hmm. There were 80,000 votes that came in after election night in April when ballots were allowed to be counted after that election day. This time there's way more overall voters, but they've also had more time to prepare and know about the mail voting system. So it's hard to say what the practical effect will be.
But I'm seeing here from the notes from my producers giving me in her conversation with you that Wisconsin has a shortage of poll workers.
Yes, right. So there, you know, as most people know, poll workers are generally retired people or people are, you know, older people. And in April, we had a massive shortage of poll workers for the spring mm-hmm. election. And this time around, we're seeing, you know, the same issue. You know, it's the pandemic is worse now than it was in April, you know, in Wisconsin. And I think a lot of older people are wanting to stay home to stay healthy. So the governor has said that he will use the National Guard again to help those polling locations stay open.
Wow. Molly Beck, she covers state politics and government for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, joining us from Madison. Molly, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, let's listen to a little bit of what's been happening on the campaign trail this week. Both President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden are fighting for Florida. They both held campaign rallies there just yesterday. Here's Biden at a drive-in rally in Broward County.
Ladies and gentlemen, the heart and soul of this country is at stake right here in Florida. It's up to you. You hold the key. If Florida goes blue, it's over. It's over.
And here's President Trump in Lansing, Michigan on Tuesday.
And you know what else? I'm also getting your husbands. They want to get back to work, right? They want to get back to work. We're getting your husbands back to work, and everybody wants it. And the cure can never be worse than the problem itself.
That's President Trump in Michigan on Tuesday. Well, joining us now is Molly Ball. She's Time's national political correspondent. One of her latest stories for Time is titled Donald Trump's Last Stand. She joins us from Virginia. Molly, welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks, Magna.
And also with us, Jack Beattie, On Points news analyst with us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack, hello there.
Hello, Meghna. Hello, Molly.
Okay, Molly. So if you had to give us sort of your take on a theme to draw out of this week, what would it be?
Wow. Chaos, I guess I would say.
That's the theme every week.
Exactly. News, right? It's been sort of every week for a long time now. But there is this interesting interplay of chaos and stasis, right? I think a lot of Americans are so invested in this election on one side or the other. They're sort of on the edge of their seats. Every time I log into Twitter, it feels like a mass collective panic attack. And yet at the same time, nothing changes. If you look at the polls, they've been stable for not just months, but years in terms of people's views of Donald Trump and views of, desire for democratic control. And very little has changed over the course of this presidential campaign, despite all of the shocks in the news, from the pandemic to weather to everything else. So it has been a disorienting campaign to cover for that reason, because things feel so chaotic and unstable. But underlying that, at least according to the data we have, is a very stable political environment.
Okay. Jack, we've got about a minute to go before our first break, but I'll give you your first swing at this. Chaos and stasis, what do you think?
And I would vote for a third thing, denial. The White House science office this week produced a paper saying, giving credit to the administration for, quote, ending the pandemic. As someone pointed out, this recalls Herbert Hoover in 1932. A delegation came to the White House. He said, gentlemen, you've come 60 days too late. The depression is over. The White House is pretending that this scourge is over.
So Jack Beattie and Molly Ball, stand by. When we come back, we'll talk a lot more about how to pull together the events of this week's news and, more importantly, how that helps us understand what might come next week as the end of voting nears. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is Friday, so we're trying to make sense of the news in this last week before the end of voting in the 2020 election next week, which happens on Tuesday. I'm joined today by Molly Ball. She's Times national political correspondent. Jack Beattie is also with us as well. He's On Point's news analyst. I want to just sort of take a step back here and spend a few minutes talking about the flurry of decisions that have come from the courts this week regarding the election. So, for example, let's listen to a bit of Steve Cortez, senior advisor for the Trump campaign. Yesterday on CBS, he talked about the recent Supreme Court rulings on mail-in ballot extensions.
To us, the idea of open-ended extensions past Election Day for counting invites fraud. It invites a whole lot of instability, like we saw in this country back in the year 2000 in the state of Florida. We want to try to avoid that. So, no, we want every person who's eligible to vote to be able to vote. But what we don't believe in is Democratic governors in places like Pennsylvania and North Carolina, and unfortunately, some activist judges making arbitrary decisions to say that the vote can continue 9 days after an election.
Well, also on CBS News yesterday, Senator Chris Coons, Democrat of Delaware, talked about those same rulings. He was concerned that we might see more litigation about voting.
Several justices said that this is not a settled issue. They declined to rule on it right now, just before the election. But in Pennsylvania, those ballots that are received after Election Day, but before the end of the period for mail-in ballots to be received, are going to be set aside, and this issue may be relitigated in front of the Supreme Court.
All right. Well, we want some help understanding all the cases, basically almost one a day this week that came out of the court. So joining us now is Richard Hassan. He's a professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine, author of Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. Rick Hassan, welcome to On Point.
Great to be with you.
So first of all, let's talk about the Supreme Court and the rulings that came out of there this week. If you had to describe what the court is communicating about voting this week, how would you describe it?
Well, in terms of communicating, I think it's communicating a lot of confusion. But, you know, if we dig down into what the court is actually saying, what we have is a divided court. And the court is divided on this question about whether state courts and state agencies have the power to extend voting rules during a pandemic to accommodate the fact that, for example, mail is very late. There seems to be a majority on the court that's saying that federal courts generally shouldn't be doing that. We had earlier rulings, one involving Wisconsin most recently. But in cases out of Pennsylvania and in cases out of North Carolina, the justices are divided. Some of them think that this is taking away power from the state legislature. And at least in Pennsylvania, we're going to have the ballots separated. So that way, if there's post-election litigation, it comes down really close to who's won Pennsylvania, those ballots, the fight over those ballots could go back to the Supreme Court on this very difficult legal question. And in North Carolina, similar ruling, there hasn't been an order to segregate ballots, but just last night, we had a ruling from the Eighth Circuit, the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit, saying that in Minnesota, they've got to segregate ballots, all again about these late arriving ballots.
So help me understand something. Let's bear down, I think, on the on that Pennsylvania decision, because honestly, Professor Aston, I can't keep them all straight. Is that the one where we had Justice Kavanaugh write a concurrence that had a particular footnote that got that set the legal analyst's hair on fire? Is that the one?
No,
it's not. It's not.
But, so okay. He was talking about Pennsylvania, but he was writing about it in the Wisconsin case.
In the Wisconsin case. Okay, you see, I mean, if I can't keep it straight, how can the American people keep it straight? But go ahead.
You can't be faulted for this. Wisconsin was a case that came up out of federal court. The result wasn't a surprise. The court basically saying on a 5-3 vote, federal courts can't be changing the rules close to the election. But Kavanaugh dropped a footnote where he adopted a theory, and it's the same theory that Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch lined up with in the Pennsylvania and North Carolina cases, which basically says that state legislatures are supreme in setting rules for congressional elections unless Congress itself overrides it, and that state courts and state agencies can't be coming in and changing the rules. So that makes at least four justices who would potentially roll back extensions of voting rights that have been done by state courts and state agencies, leaving Justice Barrett potentially as the deciding vote. And she stepped back. She had just joined the court this week, didn't participate in those cases. But if the cases come back, she has left open the possibility that she would participate and maybe make a 5-justice majority that would really rebalance how we think about the role of state courts and state agencies in setting election rules in the states.
So, but what's the concern about that, though? I mean, if the justices are saying that really the authority should be with state legislatures, what's the problem?
Well, one problem is a huge reliance problem. So people have voted and they've decided when they're going to mail their ballots based upon the idea that the courts had extended the deadline. If you say after the fact, well, these ballots are not going to count, then those people are going to be disenfranchised without any notice. And the court in other election contexts this year has said federal courts should not be making changes to voting rules at the last minute because that can cause voter confusion. Here, it's an even worse situation. If the Supreme Court retroactively threw out these ballots, it would cause voter disenfranchisement.
And also, the court leaves itself very open to criticism depending on what states it decides to return to in terms of this litigation, right? Because I'm already seeing people saying, well, the Supreme Court might step in cases where they could turn things around if, you know, either Biden or Trump were seen to be ahead as votes are being counted after Election Day. Is that right?
Well, right. So one thing is Justice Kavanaugh in that separate concurring opinion also echoed Trump's talking points about you don't want to have ballots counted late, which was really unnecessary to his opinion and very provocative. I'm not sure why he did that. But it's no coincidence that the main cases now are coming from Pennsylvania and North Carolina because they have a unique configuration of having Democratic dominated state Supreme Courts, Republican dominated legislatures and Democratic governors. And so it's a fight within these states about what the voting rules are. And the Supreme Court is setting itself up as potentially the final arbiter over these state fights, which is, you know, not the role that the Supreme Court normally says it's going to play in elections.
Unless you flash back to the year 2000.
Well, right, but the theory in the theory that was advanced in Bush versus Gore about the power of state legislatures, that garnered the votes of only three justices, Rehnquist, Thomas, and Scalia. The main holding was not about that. It was about equal protection. It was about treating some voters better than others in terms of the recount. So different legal theory. This is resurrecting a theory that has not commanded a majority of the court, and that would be a radical departure from how the court has handled these kinds of cases before. It would have all kinds of ramifications as well for future. Suppose that there, after the election, there's a recount, and the state Supreme Court orders certain rules to make sure that the recount goes smoothly. That, too, could be second-guessed by the United States Supreme Court.
Right. And I think this is why a lot of people are so focused on what Justice Kavanaugh said, because in 2000, he was working for the Bush campaign in Florida, right? And that note that you put that he in one of his rulings this week when he was echoing some of the things that are coming out of the Trump campaign, he talked about potentially changing a result as votes get counted, but there's no result until all votes are counted, in my rudimentary understanding about how electoral politics are supposed to work, or mechanics, I should say. But Molly and Jack, I'll start with you here. I heard you sort of murmuring there as Professor Hassan was speaking. Your thoughts on the court's decisions, almost one a day this week, Jack?
Yes, and they fit into a pattern. According to the reporting, the Republican Party is spending more than $20 million to wage more than 300 court fights all over the country to stop people voting, to stop them having their votes count, and in general to just gum up the works. It's as if they're understanding what Trump has said aloud. If there's high turnout, it will hurt me. And they're determined, the party is, to assert minority rule by judicial fiat, if necessary, to prevent people voting.
And Molly, I'll come to you in a second, but Professor Hassan, are there corollary efforts on the Biden campaign side to keep voting or counting going in opposition to state legislatures that have decided that they don't want ballots to be counted if they're received after Election Day? I'm just not clear. I don't know.
Well, both Democrats and voting rights groups have been bringing lawsuits since the pandemic began to try to expand voting rights. They've had a lot of success early on, but what ended up happening is as we got closer to the election, the appeals courts and the Supreme Court started sending the signal that these cases mostly brought in federal court, they had to be rolled back because it was infringing on the power of the states. So both sides are well lawyered up. I don't think that we're going to have a shortage of lawyers if there is a post-election dispute. I'm just hoping that it's not close enough that it comes down to a state like Pennsylvania, which has not only a number of legal issues, but also some shoddy election administration practices that could easily be fodder for a post-election contest or recount or something like that.
Molly, I appreciate your patience here, but your thoughts on what you're hearing?
Oh, well, I think it's worth pointing out the sort of big picture here, because there's three different strands to this whole judicial, I'm trying to think of a non-swear word I can use for it, cluster, if you
Hot
will.
Hot mess.
Right? Hot mess is a good one. Thank you. Because on the first of all, you have the long-running partisan and ideological battle over voting rights, which Rick, of course, is such an expert on. And this has long been something that the parties have been litigating, have been fighting over in state legislatures and so on in our tremendously, you know, complex and decentralized and messy and underfunded electoral system. So all that existed, you know, has existed for many years. You overlay that with COVID, right, which prompted so many of these changes that the states are trying to make or not trying to make, or that people are asking them to make in lawsuits to the voting rules to give people a way to vote safely amid a pandemic. And then you overlay that with Trump, who has said so many things that would have been considered out of bounds for a president or any politician to say, casting doubt on the legitimacy of the vote, making false and unfounded claims about voter fraud and about, you know, saying that he won the popular vote last time around, which is not true, and refusing to commit to accepting the results in a peaceful transfer of power. and doing all kinds of things to just undermine people's faith in the democratic system and its legitimacy, and to sort of push the envelope of what's acceptable in terms of litigation and questioning of the vote. So all of those things are colliding. And I think, as Rick and Jack point out, the upshot is that people are just confused. And this is an election where there's such high interest in it. So many people want to vote. We see that in these early turnout numbers, but you cannot blame people for being confused about what's the safest way to vote, what's the most secure way to vote, how can I be sure my vote will count. So there is the possibility for chaos that lingers beyond the election and gets very messy. And I think there's also increased attention on this issue that in a better world would hopefully prompt a big reform effort, because people are really being alerted to the fact of how many problems there are in our election system.
So, Rick Hassan, a couple more questions for you before I have to let you go. And forgive me, but I just want to return again to Justice Kavanaugh here. Did you find his writing this week, his opinions, a little weird? Because when I say weird, I mean like there were he sort of misstated the facts about what's been happening in Vermont. Things like that. I mean, is that out of the ordinary for a justice's concurrences?
So I think that you have to understand these are not cases that come up in the ordinary course where the justices have months to work on their opinions and they're fine-tuned and polished. Justices make mistakes. I recall, I think it was back in 2014, that Justice Ginsburg issued a dissent in a case involving a Texas voter ID law that came out 5 a.m. on a Saturday, just before voting was going to open up. And she had a mistake in there, and I had called it out, and the next day they corrected it. Kavanaugh's already issued a correction on his Vermont mistake, although the Vermont Secretary of State, I think, is not satisfied with the correction. That's not the main problem. I think the main problem was he wrote a lot. It was kind of fast and loose, and it was glib in talking about votes flipping. And Justice Kagan, in her separate dissent, called him out on it and said, just like you said, we don't have official winners on election night. It takes days and in many places weeks before the votes are fully counted and they're officially certified. And so it just seemed gratuitous. And it's not as though it was an oversight in his part, because Justice Kagan called him out on it. And so it just suggests to me a kind of cavalier attitude about something that people are very concerned about. And we saw it back in April when the court issued its first opinion out of Wisconsin, where the court again said, you know, like, this is an ordinary election case and it's about deference to states, and not really even recognizing that we're trying to hold safe voting in the midst of a pandemic. It just sounded to me very tone deaf more than anything else is how I would describe it.
But you wrote a little earlier this week basically telling people don't panic, because you wrote an intervention by the Supreme Court to decide the presidential election is still extremely unlikely. So tell me more about that.
So that's just based on the numbers, right? So what happened in 2000, when the last time we went to the Supreme Court, was that the election came down to one state in the Electoral College, and that state was, in the end, 500 votes apart out of millions of ballots cast. Just thinking statistically about that, very hard to imagine that happening. So it's going to have to come down to Pennsylvania or some other state that's the key state, and it's got to not be close. Now, I should point out there's a very good piece that posted on 538 yesterday about the so-called blue shift, meaning that we could start off with Trump well ahead in Pennsylvania on election night, and then as the absentee ballots are counted in a very slow process in Pennsylvania, it could take up to 2 weeks before Biden is actually declared the winner. Hmm. And so that two-week period could be very dangerous. And Trump could then be claiming don't count the votes during that period and potentially arguing for some kind of legal maneuver to try to stop the counting of the votes. But it's really hard to think of what that would be, that you could stop the counting of the votes. It's just not something that a president says it and it magically happens and the Supreme Court orders it. There'd have to be a particular legal theory, and it would have to be really enough that would call the election into question. And that's just, statistically speaking, unlikely to happen.
So we've got 1 minute left with you, Rick. Peering into next week, help us as citizens. Like, where are you going to be looking? What kind of things that might happen are you going to be looking for that could be significant? What should we be watching for?
Well, hopefully Election Day is going to go smoothly. There's going to be long lines in places. There are going to be places where there are, you know, small problems, but it's important for the media not to blow those up into claiming that there's chaos in the election. Once the votes are, people are done voting, then we're going to be looking at the vote counts and how all of that is going to go and whether it's going to be close enough to go into overtime.
You've also said the word Pennsylvania about 10 times in this conversation, so I'm going to presume you're going to be watching Pennsylvania closely, too. Rick Hassin, professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine, author of Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty and Molly Ball, stand by. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the campaigns themselves and what they have been doing this week and what that tells us about what might happen next week. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is Friday. We're trying to make sense of yet another big week in the news, especially as we vault as a nation into next week and Tuesday, the end of voting in election 2020. Here is President Donald Trump at a campaign rally in Bullhead City, Arizona, this past Wednesday, claiming that the United States is on the road to recovery against the pandemic.
And a safe vaccine is coming very quickly. You're going to have it momentarily. That eradicates the virus, and we're rounding the turn regardless. You know that. We've got the vaccine. I say regardless. They'll say, well, maybe you don't. We have it. Great companies. And quickly ends the pandemic. Should have never come here from China. They should have never let it out. We'll never forget. All over the world. All over the world. You see what's happening in Europe. All over the world. Normal life will fully resume. That's what we want, right?
President Trump in Arizona, no vaccine has fully been approved by the FDA thus far. Here's former Vice President Joe Biden on Wednesday as well in Wilmington, Delaware.
I'm not running on the false promise of being able to end this pandemic by flipping a switch. But what I can promise you is this. We will start on day one doing the right things. We'll let science drive our decisions. We will deal honestly with the American people. And we'll never, ever, ever quit.
Former Vice President Biden on Wednesday. Molly, in those two clips, I feel like I hear one of the biggest differences in this campaign. Because it's hard to escape the idea that this is purely a referendum on President Trump's leadership of this country.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think those clips are a perfect encapsulation of these two candidates and their closing messages. On COVID, certainly, we have heard the president, he's gone back and forth, but he's really returned to the well, to his opening message when it came to COVID, which was to downplay it, to say it's really not that bad and everything is fine. And you shouldn't believe all these people who are telling you how bad everything is. It's an ill-timed message, considering the way that the virus is surging right now and the way that people can see that in their own lives. Biden, for his part, he has made this about the competence and performance of the government on this issue, but also in general, right? He's been talking from the beginning about Trump as an unfit leader for the country, as a divisive figure, as someone who is not capable of running the federal government in a responsible way. So this all sort of dovetails with his original message as well. I will say, though, that what's not accurate about listening to those clips is Trump is quite topical there. Mm. He's talking about what's actually happening. But if you go out to a Donald Trump event, as I've done a couple times recently, he's all over the place. And he's talking about Hunter Biden. He's talking about Hillary Clinton's emails still. He's talking about all kinds of subjects. Whereas Biden's campaign has been quite disciplined, quite focused. If you go to two or three Biden events or Biden speeches, you're likely to hear the same message over and over again. That's sort of political campaigning 101, be disciplined, be consistent. But it isn't something that has ever been part of Trump's philosophy. Mm.
Jack, to a certain degree, well, not to a certain degree, completely, Donald Trump has always been Donald Trump, right? Let Trump be Trump was the motto, an unofficial motto of his first campaign. So him being all over the place in these rallies, interesting, also maybe not entirely unexpected. But what I wonder is, these are messages that certainly play well with his most fervent supporters, with his base. But it doesn't seem to be at all, even as Molly's pointing out in the closing argument phase of a campaign, that the president is trying to reach beyond that to whomever those persuadable voters out there still might be, or people who haven't been motivated to vote before. I don't see the president reaching for those people.
No, he really gave up on that the day after his election in 2016. He's been governing for his base. And essentially, he's running against blue America. I mean, he's running against the emerging American majority. You know, 7 of the 8 last presidential elections, the Democrats have won a majority of the vote, or won more votes. And that majority is ready to emerge again. And Trump is and his people are trying in as hard as they can to beat it back via the courts and so on, instead of what was it was open to Trump from the beginning, trying to get some of that coalition for himself, trying to, move into the Democratic, if not base, then penumbra. He hasn't. And he live by the base and die by the base. And we'll have to see what it's going to be for him.
And Molly, is that base as tightly knit as it was in 2016?
Yes, in the sense that there is still a quite fervent movement around Trump, mm-hmm. as you heard mm-hmm. The other Molly saying earlier, these Trump rallies continue to draw huge crowds. But Trump has never seemed aware of the fact that not every vote comes from that fervent core of support, that there are that first of all, that base of support is not 50% or even 40% of the voting public, and that there are a lot of people who may have, held their nose and voted for Trump last time around, people who aren't all in on every single thing he says. So the base is still there, absolutely. It's solid. It believes in Trump to an extreme yeah. degree, but it's not the whole of the electorate or even close to him.
Well, I think, let me rephrase my awkwardly phrased question there before. I mean, maybe since you mentioned Molly Beck from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, who we opened with. So, for example, the importance this time around as well of those upper Midwest states in the United States. One of the hot takes, if I can put it that way, from 2016 amongst us here in the media was that the Trump campaign, Donald Trump's victory, electoral victory, was the sign of this like surging white middle class vote that coalesced around Trump. Are you saying that we're not really quite seeing that now, or the extent that we will see that will be played out next week?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, nobody knows how the election is going to go, yeah. who's going to win and who's going to win in those states in particular. But we have seen a lot of signs of a falling off for Trump in those upper Midwest states. Let's not forget in the 2018 midterms, which saw record turnout for a midterm election, the highest in 100 years. And so, you know, there, it's clear that there has been a groundswell of support for Trump from places that people didn't expect for a Republican candidate in 2016. But it's also clear that there has been a counter effect, an equal and opposite reaction, if you will, of people coming out to vote against Trump. And so in polls, you see that while Trump supporters overall are more excited to vote for their candidate, Democrats are extremely enthusiastic to vote, not necessarily for Joe Biden, but against Donald Trump. And so there is a lot of enthusiasm on both sides, but it's all really focused on Trump, right, including in those states.
So, Jack, what is that telling you about American voters?
Well, it's a triumph of sort of negative partisanship, as they say. You don't vote for the person, you know, you're voting against the other party as much as for your person. But there does seem to be a strong feeling among Democrats that this election is theirs. The polls have suggested that for over a year. I have seen nothing to change that in the last few days. It matters crucially, as President Obama has said, that Joe Biden wins convincingly, and that he wins in such a way that he would obviate the Pennsylvania detour, which could take them to places they don't want to go. So people, Democrats, hope for that. And interestingly, I think I'm correct in this, Florida may report the election night because of their procedures and counting ballots and so on. And if that's the case, and if Biden, as he said the other day, wins Florida, it's probably over.
Molly, do you, Jack, with all, sorry, I'm going to go back to you for one second, Jack. With all due respect, I suppose from, you know, 2000 and 2016, I have just lost my ability to have any sort of concerted faith in what polls tell us, even if they're, as Molly was pointing out earlier, remarkably steady. It gives me sends a little shiver down my spine of nervousness to think that we can use them for any absolute predictive value for next week.
Well, I'm not predicting. I'm just saying, you know, that if that happens, if Florida goes, everybody on the Democratic side can breathe a sigh of relief. Donald Trump will not win the presidency.
Okay. Molly, your quick thoughts about that?
The polls could be wrong. The polls could always be wrong. We should always be humble about that. We don't know what's going to happen. The future hasn't happened yet. So I'm sorry if that doesn't help you sleep at night, but nothing's over till it's over. And that's why we have to wait until Tuesday or possibly later to know who wins this election.
You know, headspace sleep casts are what help me sleep at night.
Ambien.
A little meditation, melatonin, whatever it might be. But Molly, I have 30 seconds left. I just want to give you the last word here because you talked about closing arguments. I mean, in your travels around, like, just what's your thought about the closing of this 2020 election?
It's really all about the pandemic. And as much as the president would like it to be about something else, and he continues to try to make it about something else, it is so clear that the pandemic is the top of every voter's mind, especially with the way it's coming back right now. There's just no avoiding it as the main topic of this campaign. And for whoever ends up winning the presidency, it's going to be the crisis that's going to define their next term.
Yeah. And just yesterday, the United States recorded more than 90,000 new COVID positive cases for the first time. Molly Ball, Times National Political Correspondent. Always great to have you, Molly. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And Jack Beattie, On Point News Analyst. Jack, thank you as always.
Thank you, Megda.
Well, the pandemic is most certainly still with us, and cases, as I mentioned, are surging. So next week, we're going to be talking about this new wave of COVID cases in the United States and in Europe. For many healthcare workers, this new spike means they have barely had a moment to step back fully from the first massive wave of cases that hit this spring. And memories of that first wave are still fresh and raw. Emma Rome remembers. Back in March, she watched evidence of the coronavirus's deadliness literally walk into her hospital.
He was like an otherwise healthy man in his early 60s, and he had walked into the hospital, and he was intubated within 20 minutes or a half an hour of coming to the hospital that he had walked into. And that was this very eye-opening, like, man, this is a really scary virus.
By then, Emma, an emergency room nurse at Massachusetts General Hospital, knew her whole life was about to change.
But I think what was hard was just being afraid of getting it and being afraid of, you know, that maybe my mask that had been cleaned three times wasn't, the seal wasn't going to be as good. And, you know, just that stuff that there was no real way of knowing.
And no time to really think about it, because COVID cases were rising fast.
When the tents went up, it felt apocalyptic. Like, they had turned the ambulance bay then into, like, this testing center, which was great, obviously, so people could get tested. But I think it was just, you know, it was just really wild. And you can always see people have, like, a special symbol, I guess, on their like electronic chart that shows if they have it. And I remember just sitting there and looking, you know, in the area I was with, and every single patient having it. We definitely are just as busy as we were in the before times, but it's very challenging because everybody needs to be 6 feet apart. So we reach capacity in a different way and much sooner. You know, we're anticipating this other big surge, and we're already kind of starting to see an uptick. And that is what really worries me for when the surge comes, is how we're possibly going to take care of everybody. And what the hospital did last time is they kind of shut everything down. So they shut down the planned surgeries. They shut down, like, a lot of the outpatient stuff. I don't think that they're going to be able to shut down all that revenue again and all those patients again. My boyfriend also worked in the ER for, I think it's 17 or 18 years, and then he was told he had to come back to the ER. They rearranged everything, and anybody who had been in the ER was told that they had to come back. And I have two stepkids who are with us half the time, and, you know, we love dearly. And it was a really hard decision because we had to decide right in the beginning of it to have them just stay with their mother. So we weren't able to see them, and it happened just very abruptly. And it was devastating. And I think seeing it resurging again reminds me how scared I was and how it wasn't that long ago. And even I was just listening to NPR, and they were talking about it surging in Wisconsin. And I got really anxious. And I remembered, you know, they talked about making the tent. And I remembered the, you know, tents we had and just how stressful it was and how alone we all were. I'm scared for it to happen again. You know, just because I know what it was like, and I think it's going to be worse this time because there's the flu, because the money stuff, you know, that we're not going to be able to shut down in the same way that we were. And I think anticipating that while knowing what I'm really getting into again is scary. I think it's really scary.
Emma Rome. She's an emergency room nurse at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. Next week, we will be talking about this massive surge again of coronavirus infections in the United States and in Europe as well. Are you seeing it where you are? How are you experiencing the pandemic now? Call us with your story at 617-353-0683. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.